So I am really pleased to have Tracy Littlejohn here with us today and guests who've come to hear Tracy. And Tracy has been living in La Crosse most of her life and participating in many different ways in service and in her work and the work with the Ho-Chunk Nation. And so she's bringing all of that experience with her, as well as her experience as a wife and a mother and a grandmother, to talk about this interdependent web and we fit in that interdependence. And so I welcome her to come forward at this time.
Hani pi, hani chara, hai pi. Ho-chunk ra'azra, choni naji winga hingaideina. Maichere ra'azra, Tracy Littlejohn ga hingaideina. Honchi kikarach, wawa jena. I was gonna do more in Ho-chunk, but my brain is not working as well this morning. Good morning. I welcome each of you. My chade, or Christian English name, my colonizer name, is Tracy Littlejohn. And my Ho-Chunk name, or what I consider to be my real name, is Choni Najiwi. And it can be translated into she who stands in front or is the first to stand. And I wasn't quite sure about that name after I got it. I was like, I don't know if that's really me. But apparently it is, because I tend to be standing in the front quite a bit. So yeah, I was born in La Crosse on French Island. And I lived there a very significant portion of my 50 years. And, excuse me. But when I was asked to come here to Winona, I had no problem with agreeing to that, because this also is the land of my ancestors. When we go back beyond 1,000 years, beyond 2,000 years, all of the indigenous people in this area, we all came from the same people. So whether Dakota or Ho-Chunk or Sac and Fox, this is the land of my ancestors. Not to mention, I also have a father who lives here. So I've spent some time here as a child. And when I say father, I say that because the kinship structure amongst my people is much different than Western society. My biological father, all of his brothers I also call my fathers. And if my mother had been Ho-Chunk, which she's not, she is Welsh and Irish, her sisters would be my mothers. And so all of my dad's brothers, their children are also my brothers and sisters. My sister's children are my children. It gets more complicated beyond that when we start looking at my dad's sisters. My dad's sister's children are also my children. And when I've explained that to people, they're like, oh, so this person isn't really your brother. And I'm like, no, he really is. That's how I've been raised to see him and love him. And it creates a much larger family than one would normally see in Western society. And even though my biological father passed away 20 years ago, I still have other fathers that I turn to when I'm in need of guidance. And I have one biological child, but I have so many children and grandchildren. I have a biological granddaughter. Quite unexpected, my son said he was never going to have any children. And she showed up during the pandemic. And it's the most wonderful thing in the world. And there was a reason he said he never wanted to have children. He said he did not want to pass on his trauma. And when we talk about trauma amongst my people, we're talking about our intergenerational trauma. Very brief history. The Ho-Chunk were removed 7 times. And we were moved from the other side of the river. Well, we were already living over here, but the treaty said we couldn't live on the east side of the Mississippi anymore. So we had a reservation that was kind of up to Dakota and then down into Iowa. Then they sent us up to Long Prairie up in Todd County. Then they sent us over to Mankato. And then the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862 came along, and they said, no, we don't want any Native people here in Minnesota. So then they sent us to Crow Creek, which is also where Standing Rock is. If you recall, back in 2016, the Dakota Pipeline Access encampment, that place is not where we belonged. Not to mention the water was already we couldn't even drink the water there anyway. It was naturally unpotable. So eventually we were able to get a reservation in Nebraska. Well, all through that, some of my ancestors never left Wisconsin. Or if they were removed by the government, they would find their way home. But that created quite a disconnect between our people. The ones that stayed in Nebraska, the ones that were here. There were plenty of going back and forth. But then in 1879, there was a man in the U.S. Army named Richard Pratt. He was he had been in charge of a prison program. And he had prisoners of war who were all Native American. And he had an experiment that he tried with them, and that was to put them in military uniforms, teach them the Bible, give them English names, have a very strict routine all day long. And he reported that they were now becoming less savage, civilized men that were going to be useful. And so he asked the government, could I have a space where I could do this with children? And he was given Carlisle, which was the very first off-reservation Native American boarding school. Eventually, there would be over 400 of these schools run in the United States. Children were usually taken by force, not voluntarily by parents, and taken to these schools where their hair would be cut off, they would be given uniforms to wear, given new names, usually biblical names, and told they could no longer speak their language. These children were often punished if they did speak their own language. The schools would spend part of the time teaching them the Bible, learning how to read, simple arithmetic, and then the rest of the day was learning a trade, learning how to be a housewife. But at the same time, it was providing the free labor that these schools needed to keep the school running. Unfortunately, most of these schools, it was rampant to have the physical abuse and also sexual abuse of the children. And when you're told over and over and over that the life that you led, the family that you had, were bad, uncivilized, evil, it starts to stick in your head. When you're punished, when you're beaten for speaking the only language you knew repeatedly, eventually your brain tells you don't speak that language. And when you're growing up in an institution like that, where those adults are, their belief is, I am doing this for their own good. I am doing this because this is what my church tells me needs to be done. But they've also got the prejudice in their brains that these children are dirty, they're dumb, and they won't be any good until we've saved them. So they're not going to show affection to these children. They don't want an emotional attachment to a child. So these children, 6, 7 years old, are scared. If they get sick or injured, there's no one to hug them and tell them it's going to be okay. So as you're living this life as a young child, when you are excused from the school in your teen years, what are you going to do? They expect that you're going to go out and find a job as a maid, a housekeeper, doing blacksmithing or carpentry, something that they learned while they were at school. They were still Native American. People didn't want to hire people like that. If they tried to go home, some of them couldn't even communicate with their family because their brain wouldn't let them speak their own language. It's been indoctrinated into them that their family back at home was wrong. They weren't Christian. They were evil. They were savage. They were pagan. So now you have a young person who has nowhere to be. They don't belong anywhere. May or may not be able to find employment. And they feel this sense of hopelessness, no purpose in life. And we start to see more usage of alcohol, something to cope. And then they may have children of their own. And the parenting style that they had growing up was that of the adults in these boarding schools, who would beat them or rape them and show no affection. And so then we have a whole new generation of children who already didn't have good parenting from their parents. And so then we often, when we look back, we usually see 2 or 3 generations of a family that went off to these boarding schools. Then we start to see social services coming in and taking the children, because these children are being raised in a house that doesn't have enough food, not enough bedrooms. These kids' clothes are tattered. Sometimes the children were being abused by their parents. But at one point, over 50% of children in the United States that were Native American were in the foster care system or adopted out. We have found newspaper ads for a baby, Native American babies, for $10. So what ended up being an attempt by the United States to... There's lots of reasons that it happened, but in their attempt to try to save us, created an even bigger problem. Because then we were people who may not have a home to call home. Their people had been removed from their original homes years ago. They no longer have that connection to their family or their culture or their language. And they're dealing with addiction, poverty, and intergenerational trauma. Science has proven that this trauma actually does show up in the physical body. There are things in our DNA that get turned on or off because of this. For instance, Native Americans do not have the, I'm not sure if it's an enzyme, something, to know when you're drunk. and to stop drinking. When I learned that, I was like, wow, that kind of explains a lot of what I had experienced growing up and in my own life. I am bipolar. I have bipolar depression. I am not bipolar. I am perfectly fine. But as a young child, I was not connected to anything. My father was raised just down the road in Hoka, along with several other families. But it was against the law for them to practice their own ways. Somehow, basically because they were living in Minnesota, right over here in Houston County, they were able to escape my father's generation being taken to the boarding schools. My grandfather and all of his siblings were there. My great-grandfather was there. But my dad didn't get taken. They were able to stay in the schools locally. Although, because he couldn't speak English, he was put into special education. And hopefully, if there's any educators here, they realize that just because you can't speak English doesn't mean that you need special education. But back in the 50s, that's what was done. But you couldn't practice their own ways. It was against the law. We didn't have the freedom of religion until 1978. So they went to church. I don't think they went real often. But they did practice their ways in private, in secret. But when he married my mother was Catholic. I called her a recovering Catholic because there's a lot of things in Catholicism she did not agree with. In fact, she went to Aquinas in La Crosse and would argue with the priest about confession and other things that she didn't think were necessary. But my dad actually converted to Catholicism so he could marry my mother. And so being of that generation, I think what they were doing was what they thought was best for me and my brother, who were in their home. And I remember going to like this Sunday school thing when I was like, when we lived in Brownsville. That was about all I really remember of being Catholic. I do have a Catholic name, Teresa, but I have never had a reason to use it. But he was doing what I think he thought was best was, you know what, let's just raise her as any other American child. But I never was just any other average American child. Everyone could tell there was something different just by looking at me. So I knew that it wasn't just like everybody else. I knew that I was Native American. I knew that I was, at the time, Winnebago. Now we call ourselves Ho-Chunk. That's our real name. But all that I knew of that was some ceremonies and sometimes the things that my dad would teach me. I was not a very well-behaved teenager. I caused my mother lots of white hair. And so at one point, they were planning on sending me to a place called Flandreau, which was a now Bureau of Indian Education boarding school. It's no longer run by the church or the government. Well, it was still run by the government. That's the Bureau of Indian Education. But it was a boarding school that a lot of parents sent their wayward children to. And the night before I was set to leave, my grandma told my parents, don't send her there. They will kill her. And at that time, I was like, you know, I'm tougher than that. I didn't realize what she meant. But that was the first time I really heard about boarding schools. And I kind of got curious and I started to learn about these boarding schools. And then I was about 24 when I first heard about intergenerational trauma. And I started to put the two together. And I had a child at the age of 18, so my son was already starting school at that point. And I knew that I needed to make some changes. My father died in 2004. And I lost so much when he left. But like I said, I had other fathers. And I had one in particular who I hadn't grown up with, but I was just getting to know. And, you know, I had started going to our traditional feasts and starting to learn a lot from elders there. And I was starting to feel more at peace. And then my brother, who had started going to, my son was in an extremely horrible accident, and we almost lost him. And he was sent down, he was med-flighted down to Madison. And that particular father I was getting to know joined us there, and he is a medicine man, and he treated my son in our traditional way, and I do believe he saved his life. In fact, we did. He did some medicine, and at that point, all of us that were there had set our hands on my son. And about a month later, my mom was at the clinic because she had this incredible pain in her hand. And they could not find anything wrong, but there was an infection. There was no puncture, nothing. My mom was convinced that she pulled some of that illness from him while my father was doing his medicine. But then also, my brother came down there to Madison, and I told him there is a feast, and they're putting on pails for my son. He's like, I need to be here for him. And I said, no, I need you there for him. And when he came back, he completely changed. My brother had never really paid much attention, never seemed to really care about us, our Ho-Chunk side. He is now a medicine man. It suddenly hit him what he had been missing all that time. And so over the last 20 years, I have become more and more Ho-Chunk. You know, my father raised me telling me things. He told me historical things like about Abraham Lincoln, that's not the good, so not so good side. He told me once, we don't use an umbrella. Don't you use an umbrella, because that rain is water and that is a blessing. It's a gift from the Creator. You don't hide from the water. You don't run in the rain. So I don't. And it's hard for me sometimes when I do see some of my relatives who have not found their way back to the Ho-Chunk way. They've got umbrellas. Like, do you want an umbrella? I'm like, no. Why not? Dad told me no. I'm not going to do that. You know, so it's hard because some of my family has found their way back. Some of them have not. But this whole experience of my life has helped me understand who I am and how I am related to the entire world. I learned to appreciate nature much more than I did just from my father. He did a great job helping me to understand that plants and animals were not just things, that they were beings, that they had spirit. And they were no different than us, except that they looked different. They may have eaten different. They walked or flew different. I now have a much stronger concept of my relationship with all living things. And I've also found my relationship with other communities of color, other people. When I was in college, I went to college, I started when I was 26. And when I was still in school, the Hmong population were still in English as second language classes. They weren't incorporated into the mainstream classes yet. So I didn't have a whole lot of interaction with Hmong people. Enough, but not a lot to actually develop a friendship. And while I was in college, a group of us, Native and Hmong, were walking on campus, and another Ho-Chunk whistled, and I went, "Hey." And he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And one of the Hmong girls said, "Why did you hit him?" And I said, "Because we're not supposed to whistle at night." She's like, "Why?" I said, "Because it calls bad spirits." She's like, "Oh, we believe the same thing." One of their clans has a similar kinship relationship, kinship structure, as Ho-Chunks do. We started talking and finding all of these things that are similar. There is a lot of similarities in spirituality between Ho-Chunk traditional and the Hmong traditional. I have friends from around the world that are indigenous, and we find similarities. And the main thing that ties us all together is that we are land-based people, meaning we know that we belong to the land. The land does not belong to us. We belong to the land. Did anyone happen to go to UWL Thursday night to see Robin Wall Kimmerer speak? She wrote Braiding Sweetgrass. She put into words so many things that I knew, and this happens a lot. I'll meet somebody after I hear them talk, and I'm like, "You put it into words what was in my head, but I just couldn't bring it out." I was able to eat dinner with her prior to her lecture Thursday night. I'm starting to kind of think of her as like Aunt Nature instead of Mother Nature. She knows so much. She understands so much. And it's all because of her relationship to nature. Everybody, you know, a lot of my non-traditional friends kind of think I'm kind of silly, you know, because I go out in the morning and I feed my friends. I feed my bird friends. I feed our squirrel friends. And we have a lot in my tiny little yard in the city. But I talk to the trees. Talk to the plants, you know, and they say, you know, talk to your plants, they'll grow better. I don't have to talk to them to help them grow better. I talk to them because we live on the same land. We are neighbors. But Robin Kimmerer talks about reciprocity. And I'm so happy to see that so many people are starting to hear her words. Because, like I said, we belong to the land. The land doesn't belong to us. Also, everything that's on the land, it's a relationship. You know, she talks about the trees, and I love trees. But she talks about how without trees, we would not have what we need to have shelter. We would not have shade. We wouldn't have maple syrup. I love maple syrup. I was so surprised. When I found out that there was like people were tapping in February, I was like, "Oh, that's crazy, but yay, there's gonna be so much more." But she talks about there's a reciprocity. We owe just as much to nature as that what we get from nature. Now with my granddaughter, that was unexpected because my son didn't want to pass on his trauma. My job is to pass on the resiliency that my ancestors held on to make sure I was alive today. So I teach her that we go out and feed our friends in the morning, that we don't hurt our other neighbors like the trees, because I want her to have what I didn't have. I wanted her to have that connection back to the earth and to our creator from the get-go and not have to struggle until she finds her way. my son still struggles. And sometimes he's like, you know, are you going to just go live back in a chipotle, our houses? And I'm like, I don't have to go back to living that way to still be traditional Ho-Chunk. Everybody else has adapted to electricity, television, phones. I can still do that, but I can still have that connection and that respect for all of the living relatives that I have, whether they have their roots in the ground or they fly above me. One of the greatest things about living in La Crosse, me and my husband will go outside and look up in the sky, and five out of seven times, there's an eagle flying. And I absolutely love that. I am so blessed that some of my ancestors were just so stubborn to not leave. And they weren't right here, but they ended up right in Minnesota, right on the other side of the river, getting land grants over there, allotments, whatever we call them from the United States, and making sure we never were far away from the things that the Creator gave us specifically, such as the sweetgrass and the sage, the mahinch. Mahinch is a long time. Milkweed. And when I lived on French Island, the town of Campbell did not have enough money to keep their weed inspector. And all of a sudden, there's mahinch growing over there by the airport, or there's some growing back there on this road. So now I'm able to find that food and just forage for it, because it's grown up all over the place now that people are understanding that it's not a weed, because they attract the butterflies. Everybody wants the butterflies. So yay, I get food too, not just the butterflies, because we use it for food, we used it for glue, we used it for textiles. So I'm so blessed to be able to do that. So yeah, I found my way back. I found my interconnectedness with everything. So I've worked with kids a lot professionally, and what I've tried to help them with is decolonizing, letting them understand that our kinship structure is our kinship structure. You don't have to change it when you're talking to people outside of our own culture. If you got five moms, you got five moms. You don't have to say, well, they're my mom's sisters, they're my aunts, really. No, say who they are. Learning to understand what was put on us. There's so many ways that colonization has changed things that now are saying this is a traditional way, and I'm like, no, it's not. I'm basically an amateur historian now for the Ho-Chunk. Those are not our traditional ways, but colonization did that to us. So letting us decolonize, not questioning, just let us get back to who we were the way that we need to do it.
Thank you so much.
Mother stepped in.